Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Chris Ryzik. Chris is the CEO at Renaissance Venture Capital. Chris is also the recent recipient of the NVCA's Venture Vanguard Award. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Christian. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Let's start with Renaissance. Would love to learn more about the fund's investment thesis.
Sure. Well, Renaissance, when we started it in 2008, the idea was to create a new type of fund. So we're a fund of funds, and there have certainly been those before. But the idea behind Renaissance was to create a fund of funds that would first and foremost try to access the best venture capital funds around the country. Secondly, get those funds to begin actively looking at and investing in our home territory, which is Michigan. Hmm. And third, we began this in partnership with a number of Fortune 1000 and large private companies in Michigan. So the third element was to begin to use this as a way to connect those major companies with innovative startup companies. So those are the three legs of Renaissance, which is investing, creating economic impact locally, and making strategic connections. And we were the first fund to do this.
And do you remember there was a defining moment when you had the idea to launch Renaissance?
Yes. So we did it in partnership with an organization called Business Leaders for Michigan. It was it's a nonprofit CEO organization, CEOs of the biggest companies in the region. And so there had been an idea floating around the region of should we create a fund for the region. I happened to be a partner at the time in a regular venture fund based in Michigan, the largest fund in Michigan. And I'd sort of experienced this period of being in this region that had rich technology, high concentration of engineers, most of the elements to be a great startup hub. And yet we were kind of a third tier startup hub. And so I really experienced firsthand what the lack of capital in the region was doing and how it was limiting our ability to really grow this region. So I loved the idea of creating a large fund that would support the region. But there were all these other elements around it that, you know, I thought could make this more successful. A regular venture fund would be great, but a fund of funds could work to engage dozens of venture funds in the region. And then this bringing in the major companies could add an extra element of interest in the whole thing, where we're trying to invest in funds and we're actually bringing customers from these major companies. So, you know, it was a point where it was time for me to start my own fund or to run my own fund, because I'd been a partner, but a more junior partner. And this was the perfect opportunity. And I'm really thankful that in the fall of 2008, when the world seemed to be falling apart, that a number of major companies in the region got behind this idea and supported me as I tried to start this new type of vehicle.
Wow. Well, congratulations on the success. So
thank you.
Fast forward 18 years, what have you found are some of the key lessons learned investing as a fund of funds?
Yeah, so, you know, we weren't the first fund of funds to try to have a local impact. There were a lot of state-sponsored, government-sponsored fund of funds designed to increase the amount of investment in their region. They tended to have sort of that government feel, and I don't mean to be too negative, their intentions were good, but essentially they were a list of rules. And so really smart people managing these funds were kind of hamstrung in that they're going out and trying to invest in great funds around the country, attract them to their region, but they're coming with this list of rules. You have to sign a document that says you're going to invest this much in our region. You're going to have to open an office in our region. And that tended to create an adverse selection of opportunities. So one of the innovations we had is no rules. We're going to go find funds around the country, and we're going to be all carrot and no stick. So we actually, when we talk to the fund, what we tell them is we just want you to look in our region. You don't have to promise to invest because we don't want you to do bad investments. We're about everybody making money. We will actually do a lot of the groundwork for you. So the idea was we're a fund of funds, but we're actually quite involved with all the sources of start. So for instance, I'm the National Advisory Board Chair for the University of Michigan's Innovations Office, the Tech Transfer Office. We're involved with Michigan State University's Tech Transfer. We're involved with Wayne State University. So we see the stuff coming out of the universities. We're involved with every accelerator, with the idea being we are bringing opportunities to funds in which we invest. So we're not just a check, but we're bringing this capital or these sources of startups. And at the same time, we've got these relationships with these major companies, and we're going to the major companies and saying, what are the areas you're interested in? And then we can bring that to those venture funds. Nobody had done that combination. And that was really the lesson learned was there had been fund of funds that were purely financial vehicles, hopefully having impact, but they came with all these rules. Our whole idea was to make what we were offering so attractive that the best funds in the country would want to become part of our network. And that really was the difference maker. And it's worked terrific.
So I'm curious, how has the dialogue with the funds evolved over the years? And I'll play devil's advocate for a moment. I would imagine back in 08, 09, maybe there was a bit resistance for a fund that wasn't in Michigan to buy into the idea.
Well, there was, because they had experienced these state-sponsored funds that had all these rules. When they found out we didn't have rules, that resistance went away pretty quickly. When they knew that they simply had to be willing to look, but they didn't have to do investments and they didn't have to open offices, it became a net positive for them. So I guess I would say there was skepticism on the part of those funds that they would actually find something. But here we are, 18 years later almost, 17 years later, we've tracked about $3 billion of investment that's come into Michigan through our relationships. 84 companies have received investments through these relationships. So while there was probably skepticism, they found out pretty quickly, this is a region very rich in technology and very rich in startups and underserved. So the math worked pretty well too, because there weren't crazy high valuations and sure. Things like that.
I have a bunch more questions I'd like to ask about Renaissance, yeah. But before I do, we can take a step back. Would love to know about your career progression leading up to founding Renaissance in 08.
Sure. It is not a typical career path, and I would love to say I had this all planned out, but I didn't. So I graduated Michigan State University, became a CPA, worked at PwC for a bit. Then I went back to law school at University of Michigan, graduated, became an attorney and then a partner at a big national firm called Dickinson Wright, and ran the middle market practice there and could have spent the rest of my career there, but I really wanted to do something entrepreneurial outside of the law firm. It just so happened an opportunity came. A friend of mine from back in my PwC days, he had left PwC and I'm going to test your memory a little bit. He went on to become the president of Gateway, the computer company.
Oh, yeah.
Based in South Dakota. His name is Rick Snyder. And Rick moved back to Michigan and ultimately contacted me because he wanted to start a venture fund. So while I was still with the law firm, helped him start the fund. And we just hit it off really well. And he's a really smart guy. And I loved what he was doing. And about a year into that, he asked me to quit partnership I was in and become his partner. And so we became venture partners and what was then the largest fund in Michigan history. $100 million was a lot of money back then. And we were fortunate. We had some good fortune and had some real winners come out of that fund. We raised the second fund together. And then it was time for me to start my own fund. And actually, Rick went on. He left the venture world and ran for governor and became the governor of Michigan for two terms. So that was the background. It was an unexpected sort of trip into venture capital. In fact, when he first asked me to help him form the fund, I literally had to go into a library to research what venture capital was because I didn't know. Those were the early days of venture capital, particularly in the Midwest. And so, but that time working as a GP really was an education. And, you know, they say experience is what you get when you don't get what you wanted. And when I was a GP, we had some great successes. I probably learned more from the things that went wrong. But both of those informed me. And when I went to start Renaissance, it was creating a fund of funds, but with the mindset of somebody who had been a GP. And that really did affect and still affects how we operate Renaissance.
Wow. It's funny you said Gateway. I haven't thought about that in maybe over two decades, but I don't know if you know the answer, but does Rick get credit for the cow print on the boxes? Do we know?
No, that was the founder, Ted Waite. Rick came in as sort of the first sort of outside officer in the organization.
Got it. Wow, blast from the past. So yeah. You mentioned some hard lessons learned. Which are some of the top ones that come to mind?
Probably one of the first ones is trust my instincts. You know, I got into venture from a non-obvious path. And there was probably some imposter syndrome the first couple of years. But I'm a pretty smart guy. And, you know, and I had the business background. And I would say in the first few years, I probably didn't question things enough. And if somebody's pitching something to me and it doesn't make sense to me, probably in the early years, I thought maybe it didn't make sense to me because I was missing something. Over time, you kind of learn. If it doesn't make sense to you, it's probably because it doesn't make sense. And if it does make sense and I'm not getting it, I shouldn't invest in it anyway. Mm. I'm not the right person. So I think trusting instincts was a big lesson. A second question is sort of death by a thousand cuts. And that can happen a lot in venture. You write the first check. And at some point, you write the second check. At some point, you have to make a call, understanding that you've simply lost money and it's time to stop losing money. And that's difficult. You know, a lot of us, especially if we played sports, we're pretty competitive. And if you're competitive, you don't like to lose. And losing a company is losing. And it took a certain amount of time and a certain amount of discipline to say, sort of discretion is the better part of valor. It's time to just cut it off and figure this is a loss and save the remaining capital for the best deals, not for the worst deals. And I see that, you know, I experienced it firsthand, and I certainly see that, particularly in younger venture capitalists right now.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, as I listen, I'm reminding to some of the core tenets of just trading. And, you know, cut your losers short, ride your winners. And obviously the reason most people don't is just cognitive biases of associated with the ego. And so I'm curious today, while you're investing in funds, are there any markers that you'll use to say, hey, that's it, we're done? Or on the flip side, how do you make decisions to continue to add to winning positions?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a couple elements that go into how we make these decisions. One is certainly, you know, we have a view of the world, and our view right now is probably not the same as a lot of other LPs, and we could talk about that later. And so we have a view of the world, and sort of does their view of the world match our view of the world? Because again, if they're doing something that we don't believe in, we shouldn't be investing in it, and they shouldn't want us as an investor. That's part one. Part two, we do look pretty deeply at how they've run the fund in the past. Part of it is with this idea of have they cut off companies that weren't going to make it quickly? Did they get emotionally sucked in and continue? And there's some pretty simple ways, just doing an analysis to sort of see whether a fund has continued to support its winners or whether it has supported its losers trying to save them. Obviously, the way you make optimal returns is by supporting your winners, not your worst companies. And in due diligence, we can figure that out. So those two, and then the third, you know, element we look at is the people part. We like firms that have several smart people around the table who are talking to each other and are making really good decisions together, as opposed to firms that are really autocracies. Because, you know, we all have blind spots, and we like leaders who are listening to the people they brought in around them.
Are there any funds in particular that you'd love to recognize as just being, you know, a great model who do that?
You know, it's tough because I have so many good funds. I hate to, if I call out one, I can't call out another. But we're dealing with some really good funds. Some of them we've invested in 3, 4, probably the most is 5 times so far. And, you know, what makes us come back? Those things I mentioned, and of course, it's going to be strong returns, but also, you know, funds that want to be partners with us. We see things they don't see. They have a universe of one fund that they see. You know, we're talking to 5 to 7 funds every week. So we see some macro things that they don't see. One of the things that's important to us is we really want to be value-add investors. We're more than a check. We can sort of go to a fund that we've invested in and say, love what you guys are doing. Here's something to think about that we're seeing that is working in the rest of the world that maybe you haven't thought of yet. Or here's some things that you're doing that we see that not working in other places. Are they receptive to that? You know, and are they coming to us? Because as smart as they are, we know some things they don't know just from sitting at 20,000 feet.
That makes really good sense. Completely intuitive. So with that, a few moments ago, you made reference to just outlook and things that you see.
Yeah.
Venture space, what are they?
So there's a few things, yeah, that we're really talking a lot about. One is everybody talks about the impact of AI, and the impact of AI is pretty dramatic, particularly on, you know, the tech software side, but it's going to be happening in other places. So how are companies built now? If you're building a SaaS company, it's just being built differently. It's being built with a fraction of the employees that it was, and more AI tools to help with the actual coding, et cetera. So a company can get to, you know, a viable product with far less capital than it used to and quicker than it used to. Well, that changes the whole equation in venture capital, in that you can get to market quicker. And if you've got a viable product, then you have the ability to hit important value milestones quicker. Now, that's the positive side. The negative side is, you know, other people can do that too. And so, whereas technology was once a pretty big moat that you could create, it's not much of a moat anymore because other folks can develop it quickly too. So what becomes more important now is networks and relationships, selling into specific industries, having people who understand that industry, who have relationships, and getting to market quickly and getting relationships where now you're sort of tied in to those customers, making it, you know, more difficult for them to go elsewhere. Secondly, getting the data from those customers becomes another really important moat. And those are increasingly important. The tech is less important. And again, you can do that with less money and less time if you're doing it right. That then creates opportunities for exits quicker. You know, venture has this well-deserved reputation of having time frames to get longer and longer and longer. This has the ability to shorten that time frame. But, you know, you might sell that company. It may not be a unicorn. You may be selling that company for 150 or 200 million. But if it only took 20 million to get to this point, it's a win. But what's happening in the market? In the market last year, I think around 350 venture funds raised, 75% of the money went to 25 funds, the mega fund. The money is flowing to the mega funds, and they're going a different direction. They're getting bigger, and they're covering more territory, sort of money manager-ish. They can't sell a company for $150 million. Mm-hmm. They have to drive it all the way. And that's a business model. You know, we are more partial now to the business model of somewhat smaller funds that have the optionality. You know, after 3 years and $20 million, they've got the optionality to either sell the whole company or sell part of the company, get exits, and counteract that problem that we've had of investments lasting longer and longer and longer, actually getting distributions back to their investors sooner. So that is our view of the world. And increasingly, because of what we talked about with the importance of networks and understanding industries, we're looking at more and more funds that are specialists, that may specialize in a specific industry or a few industries, as opposed to being generalists. So that is counter to probably the way most people you talk to are looking at the world, but we think that is where outsized returns are going to come in the future.
What do you think the implication is for older venture vintages that are, you know, just pure SaaS? Do you feel like they're going to have a more difficult time generating a return? Or do you see just a wholesale shift to AI adoption such that they realize they don't have a choice and they're going to have to do this in order to see something that resembles a meaningful exit?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to adopt AI. It's just going to make the cost of running their business less expensive, and they're going to be able to iterate more quickly. If they don't, they will find their value going down, and they're going to be leapfrogged by newer companies that have. So yeah, and we are seeing that across the SaaS world. Companies are either adopting AI and adapting to AI, or they're starting to see this sort of value fade. And the value fade comes in if they're going to raise the next round, the investors who are coming in are going to want to know. I mean, they're going to be asking the questions about the adoption of AI and how is that impacting your team? How is that impacting the speed of your development? If you don't have a good answer, it's going to be problematic.
Makes good sense. You're in Michigan. I'd say it's fair to hazard a guess that most of our audience, myself included, thinks of Motor City and in the automotive industry. Has there been a focus on automotive over the years, or is it more broadly encompassed more of the state's industry?
Depends where you're at in the state. Detroit is still the automotive hub. And in fact, there is a pretty large sort of co-working space accelerator in Detroit called New Lab that has just taken the place by storm. It only opened 2 years ago. I think right now there's about 125 startups in it and companies moving from all over the world to be near their customer. And there's lots of other activity going on, principally in the Detroit area related to mobility. And I'm feeling pretty optimistic about advances in mobility sort of broadly defined within Detroit. Where our office is in Ann Arbor, it's the University of Michigan, the largest public research university in the country, doing $2 billion of research a year in everything. In Ann Arbor, I would say in particular, their strengths in cybersecurity, in biopharma, supply chain, in battery technology, and several others. I mean, one of the benefits is with a large university like that, it's good at just about everything, and there's a lot of research coming out. Go up the road, Michigan State University, another large research university, probably one of the two or three leaders in the nation in agricultural technology. And so we've got that sort of in the center of the state. You get on the western side of the state, and there are a lot of developments around ergonomics, furniture, a big furniture, Grand Rapids, a big furniture city, but also a very entrepreneurial city. So there's a lot going on here. You can touch just about anything within a couple hours of where we're at.
And so do you find that a lot of the success over the years has been based on the innovation coming out of the universities?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, probably I would say over half of the most successful startups have some kind of university background to them. You know, one of the things we've done at Renaissance is we do an event called Undemo Day each fall and each spring. And the idea was, again, to get these funds from around the country to see what's going on in Michigan. Well, they're not going to be walking the halls at Michigan State University or the University of Michigan. So we do that for them. But in addition, we try to make it really easy for them. So we host an event. This year, it's October 1st in Detroit at Ford Field where the Lions play. We take over Ford Field and we take applications from really all the startups in the state. We've got tentacles into all the sources of startups. Last year, I think we had 260 startups apply to participate. And it is essentially a day where we set up speed dating meetings. So last year, we had 260 startups. We have between 200 and 300 VCs come in from around the country. And we essentially run a fantasy draft. I guess since we're in Ford Field, it's the right place to do that. But we get to all the VC funds early, all this information about the startups, their pitch decks, all the background information. And then we say to the VC funds, make your draft choices. Who do you want a 20-minute meeting with? And they do. And then we set up this grid of meetings. You know, we'll schedule 600-700 meetings. And so there's a sea of tables all over the entranceway into Ford Field. And it's 20-minute meeting after 20-minute meeting after 20-minute meeting. And meetings that simply wouldn't take place. And it's super efficient for both sides to spend one day in that place. And that's been the biggest driver of the success we've talked about in getting local startups to get investments from national venture capital funds.
Wow. Well, kudos to you and the rest of the team at Renaissance for bringing that to life, because it sounds like it's a win all around.
Yes. And by the way, if folks would like to attend or learn more, undemoday.com.
Done. And we'll make sure we include that in the show notes. If you're listening to this right now,
thank you.
Do that in there. So obviously a lot of passion, but as we were talking offline too, I understand you also have a passion with soul music and launched Soul Tracks, which today, correct me if I'm wrong, is the most visited soul music website in the world.
It is.
Wow.
It is. So being in the Detroit area, you grow up, you can't help but be a soul music fan. It's sort of the music of this city. When I first got into venture, first investment I did was a company called Launch Media, which was sort of like Pandora before Pandora. It ended up getting bought and became Yahoo Music. So I'm dating myself a little bit there. But it sort of rekindled a love I had for music. And I had been a music journalist very briefly when I was in college. Thought about that as a career, but I made the right choice. But you know, after that, I sort of got the itch to write again, and actually briefly had a show on Sirius XM radio, just kind of for fun, but really wanted to write. And so I started it in my kitchen, learned how to build a website, and just started writing biographies, reviews, et cetera. Over time, started hiring writers. So now we have 8 writers around the world, and we became sort of the place to get for soul music artists to get their music reviewed. And it's kind of a niche area now. You don't hear it a lot on terrestrial radio. And so we sort of run in this parallel universe to the major media outlets, but providing the opportunity for really talented artists to be heard by our audience. And we've accumulated a pretty good audience over the years, and it's fun. So, you know, tonight at 9 o'clock, I'll be sitting in front of the TV writing an album review or a song review or something like that. That's just kind of what I do in my spare time. And I've got a number of talented writers who do the same thing.
And what year did you launch it?
2003.
I'm curious, as you reflect back, did you find that it not only was a passion project, but just a great outlet for you to complement your time at Renaissance?
Oh, sure. It's a great outlet for creativity. but also I'm sort of living it as a small business owner there. I mean, I used what I learned in venture capital in that, and I used the experiences I have in that, you know, back in venture capital. So it actually is, in a surprising way, the two do relate.
So I'm curious, given your exposure to AI with on the investing side, but now just the impact that it's having on music, what's your outlook for the future as it comes to artificial intelligence based music?
Yeah, I mean, it is the question of the week right now. You know, increasingly there's AI generated music and then sort of wrapped around this notion of AI generated artists, so that somebody on Spotify or wherever can't really tell this is artificial music from an artificial artist. And the AI is getting pretty good at making, it's not very creative music, but you know, it's something that sounds quite familiar and could be a hit. And so, I mean, there are a number of stories just in the past couple of weeks from journalists saying they were listening and they had to dig and dig and dig and dig to figure out this wasn't a real artist. And one of the ways they figured out is that there was no touring schedule. So, you know, there's a lot going on. And the ultimate question is, will people care? I'd like to think folks will care. Secondly, I think there's going to be the need for legislation to at least label something. It's okay if somebody creates AI-generated music. There should be some sort of labeling so that as a user, you know this isn't a real artist. Probably the minimum that we should do. My fear is that if you look at the universe of new music coming out on the streaming services, the percentage that is artificially created is going to get pretty high.
Sure.
It's not even clear what it is right now, but the thought that in a couple of years we could be 20, 30% artificially created music wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting your observation on tour dates, but I think the fact that, you know, the journalists who honed in on that probably revealed that there will still continue to be a place for human artists. Because I don't know that it would be the same to go, you know, sit in the field and watch a robot on stage perform their music. But I'm sure there'll be some novelty in that too, and it'll be the new generation of deadheads. Chris, you know, genuinely appreciate your time. We're getting close to wrapping up. Before we do, you know, I'd love to ask and know if you had an opportunity to go back, have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
I think I would share, you know, sort of a variant of what I said before about trusting my instincts earlier in my career. Secondly, I would say just be willing to take chances. There's certainly a lot of luck in getting to where we got now. And you know, thank you for mentioning the Venture Vanguard Award. That was a big deal to us, to our entire group. You know, we're sitting in a place that isn't really known as a venture capital hub. And to be recognized nationally for doing something innovative was a big deal. And that was really due to taking some risks. You know, and so I guess I would tell myself, you know, take calculated risks maybe a little bit earlier in the career.
Opinions as to why, I think you're in good company. Do you opinions as to why more people don't do that?
At the time I started Renaissance, I had four small kids at home. And so it was really a leap of faith to do this. And, you know, it was especially a leap of faith for my wife, who was then at that point was a stay at home mom. So, you know, my paycheck was the whole thing. And to go and create this new thing, you know, the support that she showed and the 100% confidence in me, not everybody has that. And, you know, there are times in our lives, and sometimes it's just our personalities, that like the sure thing. And I think there's a difference. One of the things I think folks need to do, and I had to do it, was to figure out what is just crazy risk and what is managed risk. And managed risk, you know, can be just a wonderful thing, as opposed to sort of, you know, crazy risk where it's like, well, it might work, it might doesn't, but I haven't even put my arms around what the elements of risk are. And so this idea of really going through and managing the risk, but still taking the risk, I think is the key.
And I'm curious, it's a bit tactical, but did you find that you were writing down what you were looking to accomplish to help kind of, you know, deal with the unknown?
I knew from the beginning of Renaissance what exactly I wanted to do. And I was a huge believer. I mean, 17 years later, we're not exactly where I thought we're going to be, but we're pretty close to where I thought we're going to be. I mean, I wasn't sure we were going to be able to raise five funds like we have, because that, you know, I'm not sure I thought that far out. But we are doing almost exactly what the goals, we've reached the goals that I wanted to reach, the methodologies we sort of figured out over time.
I love it. That's great. Before we wrap up, anyone in your personal or professional network that you'd like to recognize for having a material impact on your career?
Yeah. Boy, and I'll try to keep this brief. I have six older siblings who are like my heroes in the world. And between them and my parents, I just grew up in this house that sort of celebrated doing entrepreneurial things. And they've been like my rocks for my whole life until I met my wife, who, as I mentioned, my wife, Colette. Every time I made one of these seemingly, you know, different decisions, she never blinked an eye. And the others I mentioned my friend Rick, who first got me into venture capital at a time when I didn't know what it was. And then I've been really blessed to have put together a team around me that are so much smarter than I am. And that, more importantly, even they so believe in this mission we have of bringing venture capital to underserved geographies and underserved people, that it makes going to work a joy. So I'll just mention Jeff, Kimberly, Christina, and Jessica back at Place have just been a blessing to me.
Fantastic. Well, shout out to the siblings, Colette, and the team. That's fantastic. And obviously, I mean, it's clear they have had a material impact given the NVCA's recognition and what I've heard today. Chris, if there are any members of our audience who would like to learn more about Renaissance or get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Sure. Obviously, I'm on LinkedIn and all the others. Renaissance, it's R-E-N, like Renaissance, V is in venture, C is in capital, F is in fund.com. They can reach me at Chris at Renaissance at renvcf.com. But LinkedIn is probably as simple as anything. On Demo Day, we mentioned, I'd love to have some of your listeners who are in the VC world attend. So yeah, that's the best way.
Fantastic. And like we mentioned earlier, we'll include all of this in the show notes. So if you want to go take a look down there right now, you'll see information on Demo Day. Again, for the benefit of our audience, Chris Ryzik. Chris, thank you again. Really appreciate your time and sharing your perspective with us.
Well, thanks, Christian. And thanks for what you're doing with this podcast. It's important. It's just important to get this out to the world, the kind of things you're doing. I've watched some of the old ones and they're terrific.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Like you, I'm very fortunate and also have an amazing spouse, team. So yes, also count my blessings, but our pleasure. And with that, again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of FinStrat Management. And this has been another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.